Hello everyone, and welcome to my very first episode here on the Braincast channel. My name is Kira Benn, and I'm currently a second year medical neuroscience student here at the University of Sussex. I'm going to be starting a new series here where I'm hoping to interview academics and researchers here at Sussex and gain some insights into their academic journeys. So, like I said, I'm currently in my second year, and the future feels like it's very quickly approaching, and I feel like many people feel the same way. So my hope is to bring everyone, including myself, some comfort. So I'm hoping to put all of our minds at ease once we realize that there is no one way of getting to where we want to go. Everyone's journey is different, and no matter what we do, it's going to be okay. Ironically, my first guest isn't actually from the University of Sussex, but she is amazing. She's joining us all the way from Denmark. Her name is Leah. And she is a postdoctoral fellow at Aarhus University, which I had the pleasure of visiting in the summer. So, Leah, welcome to Braincast. Thank you so much for joining me today. I was going to start with a little icebreaker, which is the question that everyone on the neuroscience committee had to answer at the start of the year. So, which part of the brain would you be and why?
So, thank you, Kira, first for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here. And I think, in fact, that's a wonderful question because all scientists have their own, you know, obsession with a structure in the brain. I think that's very common in neuroscience. I don't think it's that common in other fields, you know, like, yes, my favorite cardiovascular structure is the auricula. I don't think that works for all the fields, but for sure in neuroscience. And I think my favorite structure is the hippocampus.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I come from the thinking that we are what we have experienced in our life, right? Memories shape our decisions, our way to behave, how we interact with the environment is based on what we learned before. And the hippocampus is the structure that encodes all of this, right? Participates in the encoding of all of this. So I think in that sense, it determines a lot of what you are. And that's maybe the reason I like it. Have to say also that it's beautiful in humans and in animals. So why not? It's, you know, it's useful and beautiful. So I think it's a good combination.
It's a very pretty structure.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's great. That's a great answer. So we'll just jump right in to your academic history. So talk about where you've studied previously, and then touch on, because as I mentioned before, you're in Denmark at the moment, and I've also studied in Brazil. So it'd be really interesting to hear about the journey you've taken to get where you are now, which is such an incredible place.
Yeah, well, it's going to be difficult to keep it short, but I will do my best. I think it's a curious story that has the same proportions of lucky, effort, failure, and success. You know, all of those help to shape the way. But, you know, I never thought of becoming a behavioral neuroscientist when I was younger because I didn't know that exists. You know, like you don't grow up and say, well, when I grow, I want to be a behavioral neuroscientist. You know, that's not the kind of obvious career. Have to say the signs were there very early. I used to have these hamsters, and I love to do mazes for them to learn when I was young. So I think there's something there that, that there were signs that point to this. But in fact, I almost study philosophy. So when I was very interested in why we are what we are. Right? How we behave different, and at some point we behave the same. And how we interact with the environment, right? That was my kind of obsession at the time. And I was, for some reason, I thought that the answer was in philosophy, right? Do you see? So I was reading a lot of philosophy, but also like existential literature and all of these. And that combined with the fact that when I had to choose between pathways, my high school professors sit with me and said, "You know, Leah, you are not made for science. You're not." Really, 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 really. My mom loves to tell that story, you know. She said, and she said, like trying to help me make a decision, you know, because I didn't know what path to choose. Yeah, you see, these people, you may like it, but it's just not for you. So just choose something different. And of course, if your teacher says that, what well, you say, well, she knows what she's doing, right? So I
Yeah, clearly I'm
choose,
not supposed to be here then.
right?
Yeah.
That was my conclusion also. So I choose Latin, Greek, philosophy, and art history as my main
Wow.
pathway in high school. And luckily, I had a cousin that had to study chemistry. And I told him, right, like, I'm not good. You know, I'm not good in science. I need to choose another thing. He said, of course not. Like, you need to do it because you like it. So why not? Then I changed back. And then biology, chemistry, physics, and math, and all of that. And I think that's the best, like, that helped me a lot in my life to see how you cannot let people define your career pathways based on, you know, the limited experience they have with you because they don't know enough to really, right? So you need to contextualize the advice you get from everyone and see whether it really applies to you or is just a biased opinion of someone that comes from a different perspective of you. So I think that was in fact very useful for my life, for my academic pathway itself, to follow my own gut and take advice, but in a ponderate way, you know. That was very helpful in some way.
I think that'll be so useful because I think there's a lot of that here as well. Because I think you have your, you put your teachers up on this pedestal and you just take everything that they say is gospel. So if they're telling you like this is not for you, then it's like, oh, and when you already have like doubts in yourself as well, I feel like that's just one thing that's like, okay, they said I can't do it, I can't do it.
Exactly. That's exactly what I thought at the moment. And that's exactly what we shouldn't, right? Like, so it's an interesting learning experience very early in my career. And I still think about it. You know, every time I need to decide and someone tells me something, I think that math professor is like, no, you know, I'm not going through that pathway again. So it was very, very nice, in fact. Contradictorily, it was nice at the end. But yeah, so I decided to go through science. But again, when I had to choose my bachelor, right, I was again between philosophy and biotechnology because it was always like a permanent obsession in my life of what to do. And for randomness and luckily in life, I passed in biotechnology. That was my main bachelor. And I choose it mostly because, you know, it has a lot of chemistry, biology, engineer, math. So I thought that I was buying time to choose a field, and
Oh,
I
see,
didn't have access to, you know, a good background in all these other fields.
Okay, yeah, just like, yeah, keeping your options open kind of thing.
Exactly. And I have to say it was extremely boring. I just want to say that because it seems sometimes, you know, that when you see the scientist is like this image, like, yeah, for sure they enjoy the bachelor and everything, and they love, but you know, you don't, and there is a lot of generalistic knowledge that you just don't enjoy.
Oh, so general.
Exactly. You just and you need to be patient because at some point of your life that is gonna make sense. You know, I use many things from my bachelor that I hate to study at that time. But you just need time and patience to see the purpose of that at some point, right?
Did you evolution? Because we did a lot of like evolutionary like animals in first year.
I hate it, okay? And
Me
now
too.
that I work with rodents and I read the studies with the flea,
Oh.
with other animal models, then I see all the value of these evolutionary classes in
I've never
biology.
made that link before. Wow.
Yeah, it's very useful, you know, to see, yes, because the flea has this pathway here and this structure that has not, it's very useful. You just don't have the context to understand that is useful, right? And I
Okay.
think
That makes a lot more sense.
that's something in education that I really think we should give it a change, you know, maybe present it another way because all information could be engaging and exciting. It's just how you present it, right?
100%.
And it was curious because I was in that moment, you know, that I like science, that I was not super in love with biotechnology. So I decided to do an internship, and I had two choices. I was studying in Barcelona at that time. I come from the other region in Spain. So I moved to Barcelona to do the bachelor, and then I had two choices for my internship: France and Brazil. And what do you think? A 20-year-old living like very close to France would choose, of course, Brazil. Of course, Brazil. Right? Like,
Obviously.
I mean, France for me was like my neighbor. So
Yeah.
I really want to take this opportunity to, put myself in a totally different culture and just learn something, right? And being, learn something about it. So I moved to Brazil, and that was what really defined my career in academia. I would not be in academia without that, I'm sure of that. Because I moved there, and after being in Barcelona, you learn a lot about practical stuff in the lab. So very advanced training, like technical
Okay.
training, you end up the bachelor like super well prepared to work
That's good then.
in a lab. Very good. However, the lectures about, the diameter of a molecule and where the electron is in this molecule, and it was just so overwhelming because you don't engage
Yeah.
with this information, right? It didn't make sense for you. But when I moved to Brazil to do this internship, I took many lectures there, and I had to do 1 year bachelor, part of my bachelor in there. So it was a
Okay.
very long period. And then it was so interesting to see this shift in how I was learning,
Okay.
because they focus on the historical background of things, of the theories that influence the field, on
Oh,
how
okay.
diameter of the molecule, in fact, is important because it makes possible to do this with it.
Yeah, okay.
You
So
see?
they're putting the links there, so it's like it makes you engage more because it's relevant to what you want to do. Yeah.
Exactly. So you have a context and a more, a context where you can embed this boring information and make it interesting.
Yeah.
Right? So
Yeah.
that was very interesting for me to see this other way of studying. And after talking with many of the professors in there, because they're also very approachable and they promote a lot of debates at class, so it's
Oh,
very
that's really nice.
easy. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
very, very easy to really go through the things in another way and relate with knowledge in another way. And my conclusion was that this way of teaching came from bringing their academic job, their scientist
Yeah.
related job into the classroom.
Oh, I
Because
see.
when you study something as an academic, you are in a field that is very like small
Yeah.
and focused, but is embedded in a broader context that you
Yeah.
also have. Right? So when you
Yeah.
start studying something, you are gonna read the seminal papers of this subject, and you are gonna read a couple of reviews that give you some theory. And so they do that for teaching.
Yeah. That's I like that dynamic a lot though.
Right?
Yeah.
It's more engaging. You
Yeah.
can really engage with information that is useless at the beginning, but then you see why it makes sense. You don't make just random jumps between topics. You relate and create knowledge about it.
Yeah. So with the teachings more like a conversation than like
Much
just being
more.
spoken to? It's like a backwards and forwards.
Much
Everyone's
more.
getting involved. Okay, yeah.
Much more. They are really like they create a more interactive environment.
Yeah.
Not by using technological or technological tools or apps or, but just by talking and
Yeah.
letting students talk.
So simple.
Right? So it was very impactful for me to realize that academia was that nice, and it could be that nice, and that I could have all these big context for the questions I want to ask,
Yeah.
and combine these with specific hypotheses of, what I want to test. And that's the way I decide to enter academia, in fact, and pursue like a PhD and all the. So I come back to Spain. I did my bachelor I finished my bachelor, and then I got a gap year because I didn't know the field yet. You know, I see, I was always like very. It took me a while to make decisions. So I took a gap year working in this just normal job, McDonald's, telemarketing, just, you know.
Yeah.
And I decided to enroll myself in a master in biomedical, translational biomedical research.
Okay.
And I was at that time, I really liked microbiology for some random reason that
Okay,
I
yeah,
never
just for
understood,
that.
you know, it's just a jump in the, in my, but I love the idea that different microorganisms behave very different and they have like their own strategies to
Yeah.
react to danger based on their, you know, genetical background. So I found
Yeah.
that very interesting. So I said, okay, if I like microbiology, better to do something in neuroscience because I also like it, to be sure that I prefer microbiology. So I knew
Okay, yeah.
about microbiology. So I did my neuroscience trial during
Okay,
my
was that
master.
like a module?
Yeah, I had to choose like what I was gonna do for my practical part of the master
Oh, I see. Yeah.
to develop my thesis. So
Yeah.
I said, I'm gonna do it in neuroscience because I like microbiology. I know it doesn't make sense, but at that time point, you know, it seemed like more reasonable thing to do. So, and I'm very happy I did it that way
Oh my
because
goodness.
so I said, okay, if I want to be in academia because I went to Brazil, then I should go to Brazil again, right?
Yeah.
In this different stage of my career to see if I still like this. So I checked in the same university, Universidade Federal de Minas Gerais in Brazil, the different groups, and I found this professor, Fabrício Moreira, that was working with the endocannabinoid system,
Okay.
especially in behavior and maladaptive behavior. And
Yeah.
how it's involved in shaping behavior, and how we can use our knowledge about the endocannabinoid system to develop new treatments at some point.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it was a hot topic at the time, you know, cannabinoids. It's like a little like psychedelics today, probably. Yeah,
Yeah.
but I found it very interesting. So I contacted him and say, look, I don't know if I like neuroscience,
Yeah.
but I really like what you do. This is my background, and I want to go to your lab for my master. What do you think? And he said, you're welcome when you arrive. And then I moved to Brazil again for, yes, for 6 months. And that was the moment I realized, like, okay, it is neuroscience. So I
Wow.
decided to move on and do the PhD with him on that
Yeah.
topic.
Yeah, so you just continued like from the masters and just developed it more on the PhD.
Yeah. In fact, my PhD was also a huge failure at the beginning
Oh,
because,
okay.
yes, I chose pharmacology of depression at the beginning. My project failed.
Okay.
Hopefully, like, luckily for me, I was developing a project in fear memories and
Yeah.
endocannabinoids in fear memories that was working very well. So
Well,
my
that's good.
side
Yeah.
project became my
Yeah.
main project. And from there, I just been studying fear memories from different perspective, and
That's amazing. Yeah. Thank goodness you did the neuroscience practical, otherwise this wouldn't be here today.
practical advice for neuroscience.
I was saying thank God you did the practical, otherwise you wouldn't be here today. So, thank you for doing neuroscience.
Thank you. Thank you very
Yeah.
much. It was you see, it was a long journey, but I did it at the
You're
end.
here. Yeah. And I'm very excited to talk about what you're doing now, but I won't jump ahead, so it's very exciting. Okay, so is that like a good generalization on your academic history? Okay, perfect. I guess we've already kind of touched on this, about the different ways of learning in Brazil. So you've done some studying in like Denmark, which is where you are currently, and Brazil, Spain. I'm just wondering, like, what are the main advantages you think of studying in these different places? Like the pros and cons of each place, because obviously the Brazil had the interactive teaching. I think Denmark, while I was there, it felt quite interactive as well. It was quite a nice vibe there.
I haven't been in Spain before, so I have no idea what that's like, but some ideas on that would be quite nice.
Yeah, well, I end up in Denmark because it's nice to touch about the Denmark topic because, you know, I also end up here like very by luck in some way because during my PhD, I want to do an internship and I was going to Germany.
Okay.
And the day before applying for the grant to go to
Yeah.
Germany, the professor, which I would not say the name, just didn't
Okay.
answer anymore.
No response.
No response
Wow.
with all the documents ready and everything. So my supervisor had a collaboration here in Denmark with Samia Joka, which
Yeah.
is an amazing researcher in the field of cannabinoids, but also depression and
Okay.
psychiatric disorders. And she accepted to apply with me with less than a 24-hour notice. So
Wow.
she was my life savior, and that's the
Yeah.
way I came here
Yeah.
to Denmark during my PhD, and then I end up applying for a postdoc, and I've been here for the last 2, 3 years.
Wow.
But Denmark is a very, it was a huge shock, you know, leaving
Yeah.
Brazil to come like to the north of the north,
Yeah.
not to Europe like Spain or Italy,
Yeah.
the north of the north.
Very follow.
Yeah, and I think it's very challenging
Okay.
to move around that much,
Yeah.
but I think it has a great impact in your career and in
Okay.
your scientific thinking.
Okay, yeah.
Because you need to have different perspectives, right? You need to
Yeah.
connect a lot. And I think when you stay for a very long time in a place, you're missing many other perspectives in the field
Yeah.
and ways of doing that could not be better or worse, but just different. And you
Yeah.
can do something about it, right?
Yeah, different is good, yeah.
So that's one of the main reasons that moved me to Young, you know, pursue all of these changes along my career. I hope at some point I stop and I, you know, I become a professor in a place and I can
You will,
just
you will.
hopefully, you know, this will come at some point. But
Yeah.
I think for now it's been interesting to have all these changes. And what has been more challenging for me is to get used to these different rhythms and
Yeah.
cultures, right?
Yeah.
In the sense that in Denmark, for example, you have wonderful opportunities in terms of funding for your own project. So you can apply and get money and support for developing your own ideas very early in your career, which I
Oh,
think it's
wow.
amazing because it's a, you know, a huge experience that you can gain in Denmark. And you have a lot of support for building networks and teamwork with other groups in the university. So I think that's also really, really exciting.
Yeah.
But the way different cultures approach
Yeah.
work is very different. So in Brazil, you work a lot. It's something closer, maybe, to the United States philosophy
Yeah.
for working in science. And in Denmark, everything is about work-life balance,
Yeah.
right? Which is what we all loved. We
Yeah.
all love to have a nice work-life balance.
Of course.
But science doesn't fit in a normal timeline,
Yeah. It's
you
not as
know?
simple as just a 9 to 5. Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, sometimes, well, there is a holiday, a national holiday, but you still have your mice in the stable and you still have a
Exactly.
behavior.
Yeah.
So, in that way, it could be different to feel that you're in a different work rhythm than the place that you are
The
working.
rest of the world. Yeah.
Exactly. So that has been challenging for me to get used to all these different work cultures
Yeah.
through my years. But I think it helps in many ways to adapt and learn what is better from each of it.
Yeah.
So I have definitely improved my work-life balance since I arrived in
Good.
Denmark.
Yeah. So, would you say you prefer the way the work-life balance is in Denmark compared to Brazil?
I would not know.
No.
I mean, I think it's something in the middle, you know. I think it's important, especially when you are an early career, you have a lot of pressure to produce a lot, to be very productive. And it's important if you feel that is what you need to do, it's important to be in an environment that allows you to do that in the easiest way possible. At the same time, I think it's important that we have, as in early careers, we have pressure to have a work-life balance. So I guess it's something in the middle of Brazil and Denmark that would be the ideal point. But in Brazil, you have a lot of freedom to have a work-life balance. For example, with my supervisor, I could take as many holidays as I need. I could, you know, if I have to work on a weekend, I could not go during the week. And that was not a point of, no, you need to be here. There was not strict hours. So that helped me a lot to just manage my time in a way. But I think if you are not good at managing your time, you can be, you know, you can burn out if you don't have pressure to take care of yourself, which is super important in science, especially in early careers.
But also, I've heard you speak about Brazil, and I know that you really like it. Well, I'd say love it in Brazil. So the balance is there. Well, I'm excited to speak about what you're doing now because you just got some amazing news. So if you want to touch on the current projects you're doing now and then mention the amazing news as well.
I'm happy too. So I came to Denmark for my postdoc. After I did this internship, I won the Marie Curie Fellowship.
Well done.
Thank you. I struggle a lot. I just gonna say that I got rejected in 10 different fellowships before.
Really?
Yes, with the same
What?
project. The
You
same
said,
project. I applied to the
okay.
same project to many foundations, and the Marie Curie was the best option of all of those. And it was the last one. So I got rejection after rejection, and it was only the Marie Curie to come out. And I was like, if I didn't got the others, of course I'm not gonna get this, but I got it.
Of course
So,
you did. It was the exact same project. You didn't make any tweaks at all. It was just the exact, wow. Okay. Well, it worked out.
but it's crazy how much rejection we need to learn to handle in the career, right? It's very tough, but at the end it works. You know, sometimes you just got a rejection, but you're gonna get something better. And if you wait a little more. So I think that's something important to keep in mind. And so I got this fellowship to come to Denmark and work in a project that focused on fear memories. Because, you know, in post-traumatic stress disorder patients, we see a lot of depression as a comorbidity. And you know, when people think about PTSD, they usually think about these classic symptoms of flashbacks and avoidance that are fear-related symptoms, right? And trauma-related symptoms. But there are other symptoms in PTSD that are less studied, that are like cognitive impairments are very common. And mood alterations are very common also. And in fact, there are diagnostic cluster for PTSD. This, yeah,
I
so
didn't
there are
know that.
in fact, most of the people don't know because it's very outside the classical symptoms, right? So I was trying to figure out why someone that is exposed to a traumatic event and develop all of these trauma-related symptoms, they also develop these other like non-fear related symptoms. And in fact, most patients, they develop depression as a comorbidity, like 50% have depression as a
Oh,
comorbidity.
that's very high, yeah.
So I wanted to study how intense fear or trauma induce these cognitive and mood alterations in the brain. What
Yeah.
is the mechanism of that? So I start to study the memory substrates in the brain, so the neurons that encode this fearful information in the hippocampus using some viral strategies. And I use two different protocol. So I study adaptive fear responses because fear is adaptive, right? We
Yeah.
need fear to survive.
Yeah.
And we also use a protocol that induces maladaptive fear responses. So for example, in this maladaptive fear, either in animals and humans, you are unable to discriminate between contexts that really are associated with this fear situation and contexts
Yeah.
that are safe.
Okay, it's like real and perceived threat. Okay.
Exactly. And you have this impairment in discrimination, pattern discrimination.
Yeah. Okay.
So that ends up for contexts that are safe, inducing fear responses because
Yeah.
you are still, you know, reacting to it. Like if
Yeah,
you've
you
got.
can't distinguish if it's a actual threat. Yeah.
Exactly. So I tag the neurons that encode this fear experience
Yeah.
that had adaptive or maladaptive responses related to it. And then I use artificial receptors expressed in these neurons that
Okay.
perceive this fearful information. And I modulate these neurons during task for assessing cognition
Yeah.
and mood-like behaviors in animals.
Wow.
So we try to switch off these neurons, the activity of these neurons that
Okay.
encode the fearful experience,
Yeah.
and see whether the animal has improvements in mood and cognition
I see. Yeah.
to see if there is a causal relationship between both of them, right?
Yeah.
So the main hypothesis was that these neurons became inappropriately active when they encode high intense fear situations. And
Yeah.
since they are active where they shouldn't be, they kind of hijack the hippocampal activity because they change the balance of activity.
Yeah.
Sure. And well, we kind of have demonstrated that now. I think
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that we have enough evidence to, you know, suggest that this is the
Wow.
mechanism.
Yeah.
So we have seen that when we switch off these neurons that encode high intense fear, but
Yeah.
not adaptive fear, only the neurons that encode maladaptive fear,
Okay.
the animals, when we switch off these neurons, the animals recover the memory performance and they have
Wow.
better responses of stress coping. And
Yeah.
yeah, so
And
that's
like less mood alterations as well.
so for mood, there's a couple of preclinical tools that we can use for mood, but most of them are quite tricky to implement. So
Yeah.
to model depressive-like behaviors and not
Yeah.
specifically mood, we're using a test that assess the responses against stressors. So
Okay.
what we're really trying to understand in this test is if the animals present despair, so they still fight to, you know,
Yeah, to live. Yeah.
the aversive situation or the stressful situation. And we have seen that when we inhibit these neurons that encode fear, they improve the
Okay.
responses in this test, and they really try to, you know, remove themselves from the stressful
Yeah.
situation. So that was the main focus of my project, and we have now like figured out more or less the microcircuit in the hippocampus that is doing this, and now we are profiling the cells that
Yeah.
encode this information to see if they're inhibitory, excitatory, where they project the network. And yeah, and we are working on that.
That is
And
amazing.
thank you. It has been a lot of work, but I'm quite happy with the result, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, at many
Surprise, that is
times.
amazing.
Yeah, we're trying our best, but I have to say, at many time points, I was sure I was not, you know, I was not able to finish this project.
Really?
Because yeah, it is, you know, science is like that. Sometimes things are going super well. Sometimes it's just a disaster and the methods
Yeah.
don't work and don't understand why. And so it's tricky. But
Yeah.
at this point, I'm quite happy with the conclusion. And the good news is that
Yeah.
we have used this data to apply for another grant. In fact, we have won a couple of prizes lately for this data in Congress. So it's been an amazing experience
Wow.
to present this to other scientists
Yeah.
and you know, recognition that the idea is interesting. In fact,
Yeah.
So what we are going to do now, we have applied with this data for more funding, and we have got a very big grant here in Denmark to follow the project. It's the DFF. And the project is going to focus on how to use this information. Right now we know these are the cells that seem to be involved in inducing these behaviors, right? These maladaptive behaviors. So what we want to do is to understand the network level, because these cells are in the hippocampus. So we want to understand how is this happening in the entire brain. Maybe a little overambitious, but
No, if anyone can do it, it's you.
we will try to do our best. We're going to use a technique that makes the brain transparent. So you can call brain imaging with a very high resolution. And we are going to see all the, or we are going to try to see all the neurons that are active during these behaviors, maladaptive behaviors, and all the neurons that are not active, or what change in these neurons when we switch off the neurons that involve the shear memory. And we are going to try to compare and see if we can do like a network level analysis of how these neurons in the hippocampus that encode extreme fear induce all these maladaptive behaviors at a brain level scale.
But I have a couple of questions about that. How is it that the brain becomes transparent? What do you do to?
So you use a series of digesting methods.
I
There
see,
is
yeah.
a couple of them. You have the Trisco, you have IDISCO. It depends a lot of the protocol. This is still a very new
Yeah.
technique.
Wow. I've never heard of it before.
So I heard in fact, I heard in a network event here in Aarhus that the professor was with me and said, "You know, I need to do this. This seems so useful from a research." So we are not using that in our lab. It's going to be a lot of implementation. And there is a couple of well-established protocols anyway. So I hope we can develop also collaborations to help us working on this.
That'd be really
But
nice.
I'm very excited about the possibility of exploring this brain level. And but the focus of the project after having this brain level is to use psychedelics.
I was going to ask about this, what the applications would be.
So the idea is to use psychedelics to see how, because we have the hypothesis that psychedelics could permanently abolish these maladaptive responses, right? Because if you treat a patient with antidepressants combined with psychotherapy, you still have a high rate of relapse. So after the patient improves, there is still a risk of, have a worsening of the symptoms. However, with psychedelics, the effect seems to be much more sustained time. And our one of the hypotheses that we're working with is that psychedelics could have this alteration at the circuit level that
I
disengage
see.
the activity of these neurons that trigger the fear circuit response. So we're trying to explore how we can use psychedelic effects to develop new therapeutical strategies, because if we can figure out how psychedelics make this and how they change the activity of these neurons at the molecular level, and we may be able to develop some treatment that is able to do the same without the effects of psychedelics.
So are you looking to shut off these neurons like permanently or just to like slow them down, if that makes sense?
I think what we would like to do, if it was possible, is to not completely switch off their activity, because I think it's important not to mess up with the memory itself. So the content must be still retrievable. But if we can disengage these neurons for the circuit that and the connections that make them overactive, and they
I see.
These structures involving your responses, we can maybe still keep the content without the responses itself.
Oh, that's really cool.
So that would be the main focus of the research. And yeah, I'm not sure whether it's something that is doable, but I think high risk projects are very fun. So why not?
I was gonna ask another question. We're talking about that psychedelics work at the circuit level, and that's why they have this more long-lasting effect. What level do antidepressants work at that make it more likely for relapse?
Yeah, that is in fact a very complicated question because there are a couple of theories of how antidepressant, classic antidepressant works. And also there are a couple of theories of how psychedelic works because both of them in different ways, both of them are going to modulate serotoninergic neurotransmission, right? But they have, first of all, different pathways through which they modulate the serotoninergic neurotransmission, but also how they affect plasticity. So there is a couple of papers showing that both psychedelics and antidepressants can promote alter plasticity through TrkB receptors, for example, and neurotrophic signaling in the brain. And there is also the different components of psychedelics itself, because not all of them act through the same exact pathway, so they have their particularities, right? So I think it's a difficult answer to differentiate between both of them at that mechanistic level. But in fear specifically, bringing out a little out of the depression field, for example, that are more studied, in fear, it is believed that both work by improving extinction. So extinction
I
is a
see.
process by which you learn that the same context that triggers this fear responses is safe. So you extinct the fear response. And this is believed to happen through the creation of a new memory in your brain, integrated by new cells that inhibit the original fear memory. So the
So like some sort of
combination,
like habituation
it's a little
or
different from habituation, but because it engage other. It has its specificities, but in extinction, I think many people use habituation to, in fact, refer to extinction. So maybe, in that sense, yeah. But in extinction, I think the biggest part is that it's not a forgetting activity, it's not a forgetting process. It is the creation of a new information phrase in your brain about this context not being what you thought it was. And the behavioral output is going to be a competition between the original memory and the new. And the when you see the effects of antidepressants and also psychedelics in extinction, you see that they improve this process. So they facilitate the creation of this new memory. And when you create this new memory, you inhibit the original one. So you don't express the fear response, but the memories is still there. The content is there, but you don't express the fear response because you have this new memory inhibiting the original memory, right? However, my main hypothesis is that different from antidepressant, classical antidepressant like SSRIs, psychedelics, they change the original memory. They not only improve extinction, but they change the original memory. And that is something I still need to show in my next project.
So you think it's changing the original memory and not forming a new one, or it's doing both?
Both. Yeah, I don't have any doubt. Well, I really think there is enough evidence that support that psychedelics improve extinction learning. However, also antidepressants. So why psychedelics have these long-term effects? Of course, you can see like network levels. So psychedelics engage in a different way, different structures in the brain, and they mess up with particular networks. But I think this hypothesis of them just altering the connectivity and fingerprint of the original memory is something that I would like to explore, because it would make sense that the long-lasting effects is because they just reconfigurate this original experience, right?
That makes a lot of sense, because if the original memory is changed, then the new memory isn't has nothing to stop because it's already changed.
Exactly. But then, because, for example, there is a lot of study about this memory and extinction memory also in animal models of addiction. So what you see a lot in addiction is the animal develops a contextual memory that pairs a context with cocaine usually, and then you do the extinction, and then the animal, doesn't go more to the context associated with cocaine after extinction, right? But then if you stress the animal starts to going back to this context, has a relapse. And this is something that's very well established in addiction, and it's something that is also established in fear memory, because you can extinct the memory and then give a very low stressor to the animal, very low, and it's gonna still recover the fear response. So, and this is what happens in the clinic, right? The person is treated, it improves, something happens, and they go back to the original situation and the symptoms reappear. So I want to use different pharmacological agents and different perspectives to understand how we can rewire and reprogram this original memory, because then we don't have a problem anymore. We just need to disengage these neurons from the circuit, right?
So wouldn't you say the treatment of psychedelics is, would it be like an injection into a particular place, or is it just like how you would take psychedelics normally?
Well, we are gonna give it by a systemic injection so that they are gonna have the full experience.
So with this systemic injection, how can it like not affect everywhere else? How do you know it's just affecting where you want it to affect? If that makes sense.
Of course, that's an amazing question. That is. It took a while to think the experimental design for that, because what we are going to do is that we are going to tag these neurons that encode this high intense maladaptive fear in the hippocampus, and then we are going to treat the animals with psychedelics, and our hypothesis is that the fear response is going to be low after the psychedelics, right? But then we are going to artificially reactivate these neurons. In animals treated with classical antidepressants, SSRIs, if you reactivate the neuron, the fear responses are reestablished. My idea is that after psychedelics, even when I reactivate these neurons, I am not able to reestablish the fear response. So that would be a strong, solid idea that, this is something else. This is messing with the neurons that encode the experience itself, and not focus on the extinction hypothesis. And then we're going to do a lot of profiling of these neurons to see, the molecular signatures of those, and try to figure out what are the local alterations in terms of molecules and in terms of circuits. So one possibility is that the psychedelics are able to disengage the connectivity of these neurons in the hippocampus with other areas that are involved in aversive
I
reactions, like
see.
the habenula or the amygdala. So maybe psychedelics bias these circuits toward other connectivity
I
instead of
see.
the connectivity. That makes sense.
No, that makes sense. That's really cool. I'm thinking way ahead here, I think, but I think it's very interesting. So, like, with the application to humans and treatment in like PTSD, how would the psychedelics, this is like linking back, how would the psychedelics be delivered? Do you think it would just be like the systemic injection again, or do you think it'd be like a targeted drug or?
So or my idea in a long-term research view is that if we can integrate these molecular and network data, so we can know which in which cell which molecule is altered to modulate the circuit, then we can find a couple of molecules that could be interesting for developing new treatments. Because, of course, psychedelics have it is difficult to implement as a mass treatment, right? You need psychological counseling during the session. You need, in many cases, to have exposure therapy. In some cases, you just go through the exposition to psychedelics. So it has been researched in many different setups, clinically speaking, with patients, but it requires someone that guides you during the psychedelic treatment.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And also, you're going to have a psychedelic experience if you take psychedelics, right? I think microdosing is being explored also, like different doses. What is the difference? Like, you can find a dose that doesn't cause the psychedelic experience, but many people suggest that the psychedelic experience itself could be important for the therapeutic effect, right? So it's been difficult to find a way to develop a method that could be implemented for real in the clinic, in the psychiatric patients, right? So I would like to develop a way of taking the best of psychedelics without taking the worst. So if we can find this way of affecting these molecular pathways in these cells to modify this part of a specific network, then we could do what psychedelics do without psychedelics. But again, this is like a very long process of profiling and validating, and how this works from the lab to the clinic is always a very long journey. But
Very long.
I really think there is a future where we can integrate more and more and more data at different scales to develop refined treatments. And I think we are working towards this in general in translational neuroscience. So
100%. Wow, that is amazing stuff. Wow. I think I was just asking questions for my own benefit at this point. Oh, wow. Sorry, I'm just stunned. So that's a current project, which sounds amazing. I think that is mostly everything. And the last bit I was going to ask, what advice you would give to up and coming students that are just like me, who are beginning their journey, and I don't know how other people feel, but to get where you are, because this is just amazing.
Well, I'm still in the middle of the way, so I can only give advice until the middle. Well, I can say that it had worked for me. And as I said at the beginning, I think everyone should put every advice on context because, there is not universal rules. There is different strategies to move through your career and to build your own profile. And I think the best part is, the most useful part is to find this strategy that works for your weakness and your strength. But maybe a couple of things that I believe are more general and work for me. I think start early and do as much as you can. So I think write reviews, mini reviews, perspective, collaborate, build your network where you are. It doesn't matter where you are. If there is an opportunity for a network there for a start learning, if it's a couple of hours a week, then that's better than nothing. And that
Exactly.
could help you build a CV for the next step. So I think that is super important. I would have it, my life would be easier if I took that advice when I was starting. So I think that's very important, and especially like write reviews and work on your theoretical background. That helps a lot for developing projects and understanding what you're doing, The other thing that I think it's people doesn't value enough, but for me it was very important, is that find environments that are supportive for your PhD. If you're going to be 3 years in a place, at least find a supportive environment.
Yes.
Because of course you need to have a good fit in the topic that you're
Yeah.
researching. And of course, this idea that you go to a lab that is, the lab in the field that
Yeah.
generates, of course, right? But I've seen many people been in those labs and quit their careers
Really?
because it's tough. I think academia has many
Yeah.
challenges, and I think when you're in an environment that is supportive and you have supervisors, and I had many, so my current supervisor here at Aarhus Gregers Wegener and Samia Joka, and my supervisor in Brazil, Fabrício Moreira, have been all of them very supportive and have value on top of everything, that you have creativity and you can develop your ideas and you have room and space to, build your own identity and opinion and help you through that process of find your way. And I think maybe that is what builds a good foundation for whatever you're going to do next and to develop your CV in all the areas possible when you have all of this help. So I think finding a good environment that is a good fit for you, because supportive environment change for every person. Every person needs different, forms of support. So I think in that sense, figuring out what you need to progress and find a place that is able to give you this, that is very important. And that is something that really determines your career in many sense.
That's
So,
something I haven't even thought about before. But when you, like you were saying, there is like there's lots of setbacks. It doesn't just go exactly as you plan it, like when you want it to. So I think, yeah, like you said, having that supportive environment, you need the people around you to be able to, just like be there for you, just on like a normal level. But yeah, that's really nice. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. It was just amazing. I'm like stunned.
Thank you. Thank you for having
Yeah,
me.
but hearing your story and how, because I think you hear a lot of just the general undergrad, master's, PhD, and you also just assume that everyone always knows exactly what's going to happen next. But to hear the different routes, that's it's so interesting. And to hear what you're doing now, yeah, it's just amazing. Well,
Thank
yeah.
you. And that just saying that doesn't change. I'm still thinking about philosophy. So I think that would be always in the back of my mind. So, yeah.
Yeah, you'll just drop out and do philosophy instead.
But yeah, I think academic career is never that linear. So there is many things that can be integrated in being a scientist. I think philosophy is an amazing skill to integrate into scientific thinking. And so,
Well, yeah. From neuroscientist to philosopher. Well, that is all for the first Braincast episode. This was the first one, by the way. I haven't done one before.
oh, I'm so glad.
Honored guest. Thank you guys for listening, and I'm excited to do another one soon.